I'm here in Enniskillen in Riverside, and I'm talking this morning. I'm talking to Oliver Breen. So it's James Oliver Breen.
James Oliver, yeah.
And so, Oliver, have you always been an Enniskillen man?
Well, my background is purely a military background, because going back to my grandfather, who was in the Royal Enniskillen Fusiliers, he done his term of duty in India, Boer War. And then when the First World War came along, he was a sergeant in the Royal Enniskillens in Finner Camp in Bundoran there. And at the same time, he trained the part of the 36th Ulster Division for the Somme. He had four sons in the Royal Enniskillens at the one time, and I understand that all four were in sergeants basically at the one time, which was a very unique thing for a family. Some of them were badly shot up during the Somme, and I myself was born in the Royal Enniskillens Barracks, the Fermanagh Light Infantry Barracks.
In 1944,
yeah. And so going down, having a military background, I suppose, more or less made my path through life in that direction. So,
and you were born into the Catholic tradition, were you?
Oh yeah, born into a Catholic tradition. You know, which is the whole family is basically all Catholics. Yes.
And so, what was your mother's name?
My mother's name was Maguire, which is the tribal name of Fermanagh, the Maguire clan. So, I suppose, yeah, I can claim the rights to the Maguire clan as well.
and was she supporting your father and your, I suppose, your tradition of military?
Tradition, yes, but I suppose when World War II came along, jobs were not very plentiful about before that. But when the war came along, the fact that Enniskillen or Lochgarran became a flying boat base for the Catalinas and those things that go out over the Atlantic to sink the U-boats and
merchant ships pass.
Yeah, all the merchant ships safe passage back to both Ireland and England, because don't forget a lot of the Irish merchant ships which had the big tricolour on the side of them actually took advantage of the coverage of the Catalinas and the Sunderlands. So I think that brought a lot of families from outside the countryside into the Enniskillen, where employment became very, very good at the time. The only thing about my father is he ended up with the Air Force, where the rest of us were Army, so he broke with family tradition, so whether he should be forgiven or not, we don't know.
But he survived the war, yeah.
Ah, yeah, he was, after the war, he became a taxi driver, you know, because here again, once the Yanks moved out for the D-Day landings, I mean, all jobs went to an all-time low, so jobs around here was not plentiful, and then, of course, being a Catholic, you were limited again to whether you got employment or not because of the religious and political problems here. So he created his own job and became a taxi man. So
I see.
So
yeah,
that's how
yeah.
he survived.
Was there many of you in the family?
There was. I had a sister and four brothers. So,
and were you? Where did you fit in?
Oh, I am second in line.
I see. So when it came to your turn then, did you join the security forces?
Well, when the troubles broke out in 69, my son was born. And later on, the B-men who were to be transferred or turned into an army unit because of whatever the politicians of the day thought about the B-men, They wanted to bring them into the army fold and to train up as army and be under army guidance. So at that particular time, I thought to myself, you know, there was several lines of thought, but we're looking for people basically to break away from the BMAN tradition and bring them into the fold of the army. And several of us here in the Corner Grade estate where I live, we talked it over and we thought it was a good idea to join what was known then as the Ulster Defence Regiment, otherwise known as the UDR. People had their own different reasons. And I thought to myself, you know, in order to break with tradition, you know, maybe we would join. My reason was that I think if there was Catholics in it, maybe trust on the roads about being stopped and searched and what have you from Catholics, maybe a thing would sort of even out and maybe bring stability back into the population. But of course that didn't work because being Catholics, were doing duty alongside B specials who are now in army uniform just simply didn't work. You were called a spy for whoever they wanted to label you as. And at home, within your own population, you were called a traitor. And that's how things went. Life in the UDR was difficult. Life at home was difficult. Many's a window was put in round. The children that were going to school were ostracised. The wife was ostracised. Neighbours didn't like you. And this is what I mean by politicians manipulating the minds of people. People only seen what they wanted to see. Didn't want to see the reasons why you wanted to join. But on the road, we were, you know, when you're doing stop checks for cars and stuff, it was quite good because you were able to give a sort of a 50-50 basis to people who were stopped, especially Catholics. You made sure that things went right and nothing could be done wrong.
I'm sure your duties from time to time would have been on the border as checkpoints. So being on the border, doing checkpoint duty, did you encounter anything?
No, we never really... yes, we did. We encountered some... I remember one night at Cassidy's Cross, we were doing a checkpoint and we heard movements in the hedges, which is, it's only about maybe 500-600 yards from the border. And this was mentioned to the patrol commander. There's people over the hedge and blah, blah, blah. And the next thing we heard, the orders mount up, we're moving out, which to me was unbelievable for a man to give an order like that. But anyway, if we had dealt with the problem that night, a couple of weeks later on, there was an ambush there at Cassidy's Cross and there was a lot of shooting done that night. I think if we had done our job the night we were on patrol, that ambush wouldn't have taken place.
I see.
You know, now those were the type of incidents you came across, which would have been frequent. But the other thing on the border that has to be said, many a night we sat with the Irish Defence Forces eating our sandwiches together on a friendly terms, and it wasn't always, eyeballing each other as the enemy.
Yeah.
We were both in there, we were both doing the same job. They were very friendly with us and we were friendly with them, and that was it.
Are you talking about the the Gardaí on the other side, or the Irish Army? Are you talking about the IRA?
No, the Irish Army. Sorry about that. I'm not too sure what they were called, the Irish Defence Forces at that time, but things weren't on a real enemy eyeball to eyeball situation. There was quite very friendly meetings, and you know, we respected each other.
And what about your colleagues that were with you? Did you form a bond, or was there suspicion between you?
There's different types of colleagues. You know, there was your Catholic colleagues, which a lot of them were eventually forced out of the UDR. But I was stubborn. I says, I will go when I decide to go. And that's what I'd done. But I had other friends who were under very suspicious circumstances, when they were going home from their barracks, or were taken away and actually tortured.
My goodness.
Yeah. Those are...
For no reason other than they were Catholics.
Well, they wanted them out, you know.
Yeah.
And, I myself, before that actually happened to a friend of mine, I was targeted, and there was actually going to be a coup within the Fermanagh part of the UDR, and they had internal disputes among themselves, but I was used as the leverage, again using a Catholic to manipulate the minds of other people for whatever gains they wanted, you know. But there was a whole company was about to be stood down, I was called into the colonel of the regiment at the time, and I was asked, would I like to resign? And I asked him, why should I resign? Am I guilty of something? And he says, no. And I says, why do you want me to resign? And he says, well, there's problems out there. It might be better if you weren't here, more or less, type of thing. And I says, well, I'll tell you what you do. Give me a direct transfer from the UDR into the Royal Irish Rangers, and that did happen. So that took me out of the UDR and all the problems that it brought along. Now, when I joined the Royal Irish Rangers, I have to admit right from the very outset that the word Catholic or anything derogatory never came in there. And whereas in the UDR, a certain major made me up to a Lance Corporal. I was a first-class soldier, Lance Corporal, but he got into some sort of problems or troubles for making me up, because that means that you have the capabilities of going ahead. Now, my rank stopped there, never to be made up within the UDR again. But once I went into the Royal Irish Rangers, I went on then, and getting promotion was no problem whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I run the local TA unit here for maybe 15 years.
Okay,
Were
you content and happy to be in that position?
Oh, yes, I was very happy and content. One of the other reasons why I joined the military, at the start I said people had various different reasons why they joined. I was very much, and still am, very much a man who is keen on shooting, and I don't mean shooting pheasants or ducks or anything. I'm talking about the single caliber rifle, which when you lay down behind a rifle, it takes a certain skill to put one bullet into a certain point, either at 100 yards or 1,000 yards, and I had that skill, and shooting was my game. And I actually went on in the Royal Irish Rangers, becoming a champion shot in the British Army. So that was one of the main reasons why I wanted to stay in the Army. But of course then there was the family tradition. The other reason why I wanted to stay on in the British uniform or the British Army was I travelled the world. I got paid for it. I was in every country in Europe. I was in Canada, America, Belgium, Holland, Europe, yes. all over North Africa, you know, and people often say, would you go here and you go there? I said, no, I don't want to go there. I've been there, you know, I got paid for it, you know. But I think throughout time, I realized, you know, that there is a terrible division among people here, and something has to be done. And as I often said to people, I said, if you want to get rid of Protestants, we'll adopt a Hitler solution and annihilate them all, and then they won't be there for you to annoy you. Or it can be the other way about. Maybe the Protestants will annihilate the whole Catholic unity, and their problems are solved. And I says, but what I will ask you all is, what is a united Ireland? And the Catholic says, whenever the goddamn Brits get out of here. And I says, no, that's not a united Ireland. A united Ireland is a united people. And that's what we have to work for.
And would you say people. That respecting each other's traditions?
Yes, respecting each other's traditions, respecting each other's religion, and a lot of respect in friendship goes a long way into achieving not a united Ireland, but a stable society, a stable population throughout the north. So from that point of view, I started off, I don't know, I didn't plan this route for myself. I found myself walking down this and getting pulled more and more into it. And as you can see here today, looking around you, the place is full of medals. All the Protestant populations who have been in the army and everything else and the police all come to my house to get their medals and everything mounted and looked after. And I have built up this trust with them over the years. And I don't want to lose that trust. I want to keep that trust.
And do you, so kind of, you, even though you were badly treated when you were in the forces that time, it doesn't upset you. It hasn't, you haven't held a grudge, in other words.
Well, you can hold, yes, there was a grudge there for a while, but I think, as I said, you have to be mature in your thoughts. You have to be, your mind has to be free from politics and religion. The Catholics were, their mind was manipulated both by politicians and the Catholic Church. The Protestants were the same. Their minds were manipulated by politicians and the Church. And politicians, no matter what side they are, will use religion as a tool for their gain. And it was up to me to show, if you will want to call them the other side or the Protestant community, that we have the same problems as each other, as I explained to you a few moments ago. Having money to go to the shop for food, staying the hell away from the doctor, keeping a car on the road, all these things. Seeing somebody lying in the hospital dying, I said, we all have the same problems.
But so kind of with that attitude, did you ever get involved in politics yourself? I mean, would you talk about
that? I answered this question to many people. Many a person asked me, would I get involved in politics, local councillor and whatever? I says, no, I wouldn't. And this is my answer. To become a local politician or a politician of any kind, you would have to be a downright liar.
Yeah.
And I ain't going down that road. What I am is what people expect of me. You accept me as I am. There'll be no lies. There'll be no mistreatment. There'll be no dishonesty of any shape or form.
So, Oliver, when did this all start? The mounting of medals and the organising of events and so on.
Well, I've been collecting medals now since, as I say, like, you know, Enniskillen was a garrison town. And of course, you're tripping over medals and badges all my life. You know, a garrison town means that there might have been five or six different regiments in the town, and medals and badges were, they were like, you know, they were like the ears of corn, plentiful. But I had this is another reason why I joined the army. I liked that type of thing. I liked the medals. As a matter of fact, I'm one of the biggest collectors of medals in this part of the world. For instance, I have a medal basically for every campaign the British Army ever fought from 1796 up to the present day. But the collection I take is a specimen medal of each battle or war, whatever they fought, to an Irishman within an Irish regiment in the British Army. That was damn difficult to achieve, but I've almost achieved it. Then I was down in Limerick one day in the antique shop opposite the John's Castle. And I went in and there was a black and tan medal there. That's only a nickname, but the proper name for it was the Cymric. And this was quite a while ago. But the guy was looking for, it could have been 35, maybe 40 years ago. So the guy was looking for 50 quid for it. And the guy that was with me, who was from Limerick, says, "That's a rip-off, come on, let it go." And he says, "But I don't care." He says, "If I don't sell it to you, I'll sell it to the Americans." And the thought just hit me right away. Here's our heritage being drained out of Ireland, heading for America, and very shortly we'll have nothing to look at. So then I decided to go into the Irish collection and collect the Irish collection. I now have, I remember being in the Irish press one day, top money paid for the 1916 medal, and at a later stage it was top money paid for the survivor's medal, which was 50 years on. And from there I put together the whole Irish War of Independence, the whole lot together. And I now go around and I give lectures, it's north or south of the border, on medals, what they are, what they're for. For instance, a lot of Irish people will have this thing under their head, medals are British, they're not British. Not one British only copied it like other countries copied it off. And the biggest supplier of medals in the world is the Papa, the Vatican City, the Catholic Church. That's the origin, that's where they all originated. And a lot of people, politicians, are trying to manipulate people about flags, about the St. George's flag. There's about six countries in the world fly the St. George's flag. It's not English. It belongs to the Catholic Church. Yeah. The cross of St. Patrick's belongs to the Catholic Church. They were the flags that were on the Crusades and adopted.
Yeah. But of all the people, you should be the one then that realizes that what a medal represents, and it in monetary terms, it should, you know, it's there, but in it's just the whole in getting a medal, in what it represents, in how you achieved getting it. Is that, how important is that to you? I mean, having the honour of getting a medal.
Well, it's a great honour to get the medals, and let's go back to the Irish medals, the 1916 medals, which was basically the first ones on the production line. The Easter Rising was a failure, or was it a failure? Because it wasn't until the leaders of the Easter Rising took place that it became a success. And from there on in, the support that they didn't have before that, they had after it. So although, militarily speaking, the 1916 Rising was a failure, the failure actually became a success. And that's the way I view it. The medals, it will always remind us of those people who fought. It will remind us of people who died for them. It will remind us of the history and the heritage that they have got for the country. Okay.
To go back to the the troubles again.
Yeah.
You said you were a great shot. Did you ever fire a gun in anger against...
No, never. That's one thing I can stand up and be proud of, that I never fired a shot in anger. Those opportunities. But, I mean, to stand up and to take one's life. I wouldn't like to be a person to say I left a wife without a husband, children without a father. And I didn't have to be part of either regime that were doing this. As I say, my views were different from other people. I'm not a conscientious objector. I suppose I was in Afghanistan and facing an enemy straight on. Yes, I suppose I would have the ability to take one down. But when you're taking a look, I mean, you can fire bullets in a street. An SLR bullet, which is the weapon that I had in my hand, the strength at the very start of the troubles, it could go through 10 people, one after the other. And if you fired a bullet at somebody, you had to ask yourself, are you taking out one? Are you taking out innocent people? What are you taking out? And you have to have a conscience for that. But later on, the British Army understood the velocity and the power in the SLR.
So what was the soldiering then all about? You know, you were a soldier.
Well, as I say, like I like the soldier, and one of my jobs in the army was I was what's known as a 120mm anti-tank gun. In other words, it was my job to blow up tanks. Later on, I was trained in guided missiles. And basically back to the shooting game, which I love. Yeah. And of course, they were all at targets. Yeah. And every time I fired a guided missile down the range, I used to say, there's my tax for the year back, because at that particular time, it cost about 15 grand. So, yeah, it was a great deal. And of course, we got away to different countries, Germany, yeah. Holland, everywhere to fire these things.
And a lot of people along the border from the south side would say that the UDR gave them a hard time, you know, that they were the worst. They were the ones who caused more trouble. And you were there. You were one of them.
Well, people can... I suppose everybody has their different little... That could very well be the case. But I can tell you another story. When we were on patrol... around Fermanagh, when we sat in the same ditch eating our tea together, having our break together, telling stories. And we meet up with those guys today, the ONE, which come up to Enniskillen. We have nights out. We go down to across the border. And I'm not going to name whereabouts we're going, because I don't have permission to say where. But we go down to them and we've invited them up to our arms on Sundays. They fly the ONE flag.
Describe what the ONE is.
The ONE is the Organization of National Ex-Servicemen and Women, which more or less is the Irish equivalent to the Royal British Legion. I actually distribute some funding for the ONE to ex-members of the Irish Defence Forces that are up around here, and we look after them. They're soldiers like us. Soldiers have a better understanding of each other.
But how long is this going on? This is going on since the ceasefire.
This has been on for years.
Before the ceasefire?
Yeah, yeah. We used to meet each other at the border, and right, it's tea time, and we'd all have our tea, and we got to know each other there. When the politicians were fighting it out in Stormont or Dublin, we were sitting... Chatting
to one another.
And today, we are the best of friends. Now, I would like to point out, wherever the story's going to go, I would like to point out Island Bridge in Dublin. And if you take a look where we have advanced today from the Protestant population, the regimental organisations, the Royal British Legion organisation, Once a year, they all go down to Island Bridge. It's normally in around the 9th, 10th, 12th of July. Island Bridge in Dublin, where various dignitaries of the British and Irish governments are there. And all those standards march behind the tricolour and they're treated with respect. Now, this is a part that the press and politicians don't bring out. They will hide the truth. They will hide the good things, but they'll highlight the bad things. But if you go down to Island Bridge and you see maybe 100 standards on parade, or British Army regimental standards, Royal British Legion standards, and they're all following, and they all respect the tricolour. When the dip comes and the national anthem comes, the soldier song comes, they all stand to attention, they give it their respect. So we have come a long way, a hell of a long way. And it's only through what I do. I bring maybe a busload down to various places below the border.
And who supports you then?
I look for funding here, there and everywhere. Well, and this is what I mean. I have got quite a high respect from the Protestants, and I'm going to keep it. They trust me, and I will be there for them, and I will not break that trust. Whatever I can do, and I'm still in certain organisations helping do this, do that, do the other thing. I mean, remembering Sunday past there, or for the last 6 years, I've been organising the trip from Dublin by the Taoiseach up to Enniskillen to Remembrance Sunday, including this one in 2017, Taoiseach Leo
Bradford.
As a tongue twister. But anyway, that Taoiseach, including Enda Kenny, who started it, came here. He just looked like an ordinary civilian. But the highlight to my Remembrance Sunday with a visit from the Republic of Ireland was the Taoiseach's ADC, who paraded the streets of Enniskillen in the Irish Defence Force uniform. That was a big thing. And this year it was a girl or a lady, whatever, commandant. And these people are a wee bit shaker, a wee bit scared. And I go over and I give them the confidence.
Yeah.
And I reassure them. I've asked the Taoiseach's press photographer. I've asked his ADC, which is a lady commandant. And they said they had a great weekend here in Enniskillen. They were so relaxed. As a matter of fact, the Taoiseach's party said they'd never seen the Taoiseach as relaxed.
Okay, so you have been the go-to man here for them. For how long?
6 years at the moment.
Imagine, yeah. And so do you find that being a Catholic and being looking after the events here, which has always been sectarian, is that strange?
Well, it's not strange to me, because as I said before to you, I have a free mind. Politics and religion doesn't control my mind, and I think that's where I slightly differ, and I have to educate people into that. And if you want respect, you have to give respect. If you want democracy, you cannot take it away from other people.
I see.
Everything has to be a 50-50 basis, or as near as damn it.
Well, your understanding of it is very good, but has there, after being traumatized in those early days, after your wife was, do you know, you were saying, what was your wife's your name?
Marie. Yeah, she died there in January last year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry, this year. No, that is also part of life. There was no surprise.
And your family then, they...
She was a bit of a smoker. So, you know.
Yeah. But your family, they've all got over it, and, you know, they must have remembered.
Oh, yeah.
Windows being broken.
They remembered. They very, very seldom do they refer to it. So like myself, I've taught them in the way, it's in the past, it's going to do you no good. But if people with any sort of a mental stress on their way of thinking or their way of life, what has happened, you know, that in its own way will make you as bad or destroy you. You have to leave the past. You don't have to forget it, but you leave it behind you and you go on ahead and create your own life. And then, of course, one of the biggest events in my life, I was in charge of the Cenotaph Guard the day of the Poppydale bombing. That was a big day.
Oh, were you there?
Oh, yes, I was there, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And so how close were you to the bomb?
I would say about 20 yards or so.
And did it affect you? I mean, did you suffer any injuries?
No, my ears were ringing for a while. But you
suffered the trauma of the carnage and the destruction.
This is where we're going into the
difficult bit.
The difficult bit. What I know, what I don't know.
Yeah. But I just wanted to ask a very broad question on it.
Yeah.
How upset were you about what you heard?
Sorry, I wonder, could you reflect about what did you hear?
So I'm reflecting to an incident that you were paid a visit at the barracks and you were asked about the sounds.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'd say it's, again, a rather touchy subject, which I think...
Without even saying, how upset were you when you heard that news?
Well, I think for the RUC to come and ask me, the question they did ask me was, I don't know, it put them in a very poor light.
Kind of changed your whole feeling about...
No, I think they knew more than...
And they were actually...
That said that knew.
Yeah.
But that's all I would like to say about it.
Let's bypass that.
I'll forget the run-up.
Yeah.
Which is seriously touchy.
All right.
And we go to the day of the bombing.
Okay.
When it went off.
Okay.
And as I say, I was there when the bomb went off and when obviously people were dazed for, I don't know, minutes or hours, but it seemed like a long time. But anyway, when it came around, you know, I looked all around me, it was just bloody carnage. And when I say bloody, I mean bloody. Everybody talks about the 11 people were killed, but I'll go into that in a moment. My first, as a soldier, my first duty was the Cenotaph Guard was blown completely dazed onto the ground. Didn't know who they were, what they were, and the weapons were lying there. Now, my first concern was to get the soldiers out back to camp with the weapons. We couldn't allow weapons to go missing. That was the first thing I'd done. Then I went over to see who I could rescue and what could be rescued. And the first two people I came along to was a next door neighbour of mine. He was nicknamed Kit Carson. And Kit Johnson. I'm thinking about the cowboy there. But he was an ambulance driver, and him and his wife, and this is the gritty people. People talk about there was 11 people killed. But if we really want to talk about what those people were like, I'll tell you, because I was there, I've seen them, and I rescued some of them. If you can imagine a 4-foot thick wall coming down across your back onto an iron rail, the iron rail which was bent over with you between the iron rail and the wall, it had a devastating effect. Some of the people were decapitated. When I don't mean that their heads were off from the neck. It all seemed to have the skull. The skull was off from above the ears and the brains were missing. Kit, him and his wife, with the force of the wall against the iron rail, they bent the rail over. But the rail kept only went so far, but it kept up. And when I went over to them, their lungs were pushed through their mouth and nose. And that is scenes that it has been in my head ever since. Other people were of a similar nature. There was two, four, I think maybe possibly five who were decapitated. I remember pulling a man by the name of Galt out and Ted Armstrong out.
I spoke to his son.
Yes, and they were RUC officers in, well, I think one was in civilian, and I think the other one was in uniform. Ted Armstrong was in uniform. I'm not sure.
Okay, but anyway, they were the victims.
They were the victims.
And then you had the survivors. I think the survivors were probably even more, you know, they had to live with this. They had to
There's some people who are living with it, and they have very much a right to be very angry with whoever done it. But it's eaten into them. It's eaten at their very soul. It's made them very bitter. And you can see it every time they're interviewed on TV. You can see this anger. It's a pity that they're holding it so long. You should be able to, as I say, you shouldn't forget it, but you should be, for your own sake and your own health and the future generations, you should be able to let it go for your own health's sake. And that's my belief. Now, whether the people have been capable of doing that, but there is some people who are still very bitter and very angry.
And why is it that the Enniskillen bombing here caused so much publicity? When you had the Omagh bombing, you had the Belfast bombings, you had all the other ones. But this one here seemed to strike a chord.
Well, it struck a chord, you know, not only with the Protestant community, but also the Catholic community. Because these people were there and they were commemorating people who died in World War One, died in World War Two, and not as some people would say, they died in a British uniform. But I believe World War One and World War Two, if the Irish man went out to fight for freedom, and they went out on the understanding, for instance, in World War One, that if they went out and fought, won the war, that Ireland would be given back to the Irish. Some had genuine reasons, but that was manipulated by politicians. The reason why it struck a chord here is because it was basically the first of innocent people who were honouring the dead. As I said to a lot of people, take the Second World War, for instance. A lot of these, for instance, today, we wouldn't have had the Catholic Church if the Germans had won. Would have been saluting to Hitler. There would have been no Catholic Church. There would be no Catholic schools. It would be jackboots. And that's what the Irishman done. He kept them out. But they're not given the credit for doing that and keeping these tyrants out.
Do you know, your story is amazing. When you look back at it, you know, you were born into a Catholic family in a very Protestant community.
Run
as well, yeah. And to have the mentality to persevere in your in what you love most, and you loved the whole military soldiering, but it followed in your family.
Well, you see, a lot of people, both Protestant and Catholic, and it took me a long time to understand the Protestant community. For instance, when you talk about the Protestant community, you know, you're talking about various different churches: the Church of Ireland, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Free Presbyterians. You know, it's such a division, it's unbelievable. And the Catholic Church again. But all these people will say, oh, I'm very religious, I go to my Mass on Sunday, I go to church on Sunday. stand up the Christian and let me see the Christian who's doing Christian work. And you don't have to be a born-again Christian to do Christian work. You know, my firm, I'm not a great Catholic, but I have the firm belief that if you live by the Ten Commandments, you're not going to go very far astray. But on saying that, I work with Monsignor Peter O'Reilly in the Catholic Church, Dean Kenneth Hall in the Church of Ireland. I work with them on a cross-community basis. I mean, I go into the church, you've seen there a few moments ago all the pictures I was taking in the church, in the St. McCartan's Church of Ireland Cathedral. Now, I walk about there, nobody passes any remarks to me. I'm like the brick in the wall. I've been there for years, so many people. And this is one way I have, of course, photography is another interest of mine, but this is another way that I can do a little service of bringing communities together. You know,
Oliver Breen, thank you. Thank you very much indeed.